Well, I thank you all again for having me this morning, zooming into you from North Carolina. And I can just start off by just saying some words of gratitude for your minister, Reverend Karen. As many of you may know, our divinity school in Chicago, Meadville Lombard, has a program that's it's a modified residency thing. So you can still live in your place of residence and then attend school periodically and doing intensives. Like as Reverend Karen may have described, we'd do all the reading beforehand and then go to Chicago for a week of, you know, eight to five classes. And that serves as the entire semester's worth of learning and classroom time. So when I started school, I got in like right on the cusp. And so I didn't go to orientation to meet anyone. So I was just kind of alone floating out here in North Carolina, but they put all of us students into little small groups of like two or three people. And my first small group was your minister, Reverend Karen, and I. So she was my lifeline to school and kind of my only point of contact in those first months as we were, embarking on this journey of ministerial development and learning and the like. So I have so much gratitude for that, and really, really honored to having been invited today to speak with y'all. So yeah, as Virginia said, I'm a third generation UU, since my grandparents planted and grew four different congregations around the country, I have kind of been attempting to follow in their footsteps. So I've been planting and growing what we call covenanted communities, which are not congregations but are deliberate communities with mostly young people who we sometimes talk about as UU adjacent. So our people, but who aren't necessarily looking for formal church, but they are looking for the things churches do, which is connection, depth, and opportunities to change the world, to do justice work. So that's basically what I do. And in addition to that, I work with many of our congregations around the country to help us collectively become better and more impactful in our efforts at social justice and particularly racial justice. Because what we can say is that our culture, the culture that we've inherited, the culture that we live within, some refer to it as a culture of separation, that it's typified by separation. So we are divided within ourselves, in our spirits, from that ache of knowing that the world could be better, more just, more peaceful, more ecologically sustainable. So we're divided within ourselves, and we're divided from one another by the severe racial and economic injustice. We're cut off from connection with wider community and from the earth by the institutions of our culture. And in this time, we especially, and have been for quite a while, facing the threat of criminalization of the other, of the demonization of immigrant and refugee people, continuing to be threatened by a rise in white nationalism, which I refer to as we are seeing and will continue to see the death throes of white supremacy. And also as we saw in the last administration, the specter of authoritarianism. One thing I think we really need to remember is that while, you know, Trump is out of office, over 70 million people still voted for him after experiencing the country with him. So I've heard comments about some of the recent violence in our nation. I've heard many commentators, including President Biden, say, you know, this is not America. But I want to say, yes, it is. We need to own up and see the fact that we live in a nation that contains all these things. And I think only acknowledging that is how we're going to start to work to dismantle these institutions of oppression, and the violence that is inherent in our culture of separation. So, you know how like every generation claims that they live in important times, and I think they're all right, but we do too. And I think we live also in a time of crisis, and really we live in this reality where we have the greatest wealth disparity in history, and that we are facing an environmental crisis that may well not be reversible. And I'm not trying to be alarmist here, but well, maybe gently alarmist. But in philosophy, there's a concept that's called soft thought, where we like kind of think something's true. So, and I like that concept because it's I think it's good never to be totally sure about you know most things philosophically. So, soft thought is we kind of think something's true. So, my viewpoint on our outlook for the now and the future, to use a funny big word, is I refer to as a soft apocalypticism. And I know it might sound kind of dumb, but we're living in an era that could possibly be the era before a calamity or within a calamity and a decline. And I think, not trying to be a downer, but just trying to speak to where we are, with, you know, with some clarity, because I think we all feel it at least a little bit. And I think we feel it through our pandemic. And I know that our young people certainly feel it as well. So mine is the first generation of people that can't expect to do better than our parents. And you know, personally, I'm aspiring to be a stay-at-home son. That's my aspiration. But we can take a look at the most popular media, at books and movies and comics today. There's this wonderful independent bookstore here in my town called Flyleaf Books, and their section for young readers, it literally on the sign it says young adult / dystopian, because so much of our media, especially you know directed at young people, is overwhelmingly dystopian. It's like zombies and dictatorships and environmental devastation. So we feel it. And I think from that we can feel an urgency to do something, to act, to find some way, any way we can, to heal those wounds of separation, to struggle and work for racial justice, and to see ourselves more and more less as you know individual actors, but as a collective, that we're in this together, that liberation only happens when it's collective. There's no other way. So I'll tell this little story, if you will. Many of you may have heard of the minister Howard Thurman, who was a mentor to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, and a prominent civil rights activist, you know, through the 50s, kind of on the earlier end of the burgeoning movement. This is a story from Howard Thurman. He and his two daughters were visiting some family in Florida. And one afternoon they went for a walk. And he and his two daughters were walking along. And then off in the distance, his daughters see this brand new, you know, shining, sparkling playground with a brand new swing set and other stuff. And they said, Dad, can we go play on the playground? And Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman said, my dear daughters, I'm sorry, but no, you cannot. You cannot go and play on that. And so they said, why? And he said, let's finish our walk. Let's go back home, get some lemonade, and then I'll try to tell you why you can't play on that playground. And so this was Florida in the 1950s, right? So they got home and sat down. They said, Dad, why wouldn't you let us play? And he said, well, that was a playground at a white school, which means you are not allowed to play on this playground. And he said, but it takes the school administration, the school board, the the town council, the mayor, the businesses in town, the banks, all of the infrastructure, and even the entire legislation of the state of Florida and the governor himself, just to keep you two girls off of that playground. And he said, that is how important you are. Because all of these forces have to be arrayed against you just to keep two little girls off of this playground. And that is how powerful you are. And so I think of that story when I think about all that is arrayed against us, all the systems and institutions of white supremacy, of violence, of ecological destruction. And this story helps remind me that we have power, that there are so many things that have to be in place to perpetuate this system. And actually, we collectively are capable of creating something new, something different. So let's see, during the Spanish Revolution in the 1930s, when the anarchists were fighting against the fascists, Franco and the like, the anarchists had this saying. They said, those who proclaim to have principles but who have no programs, like programs for social change, turn out in the end to have no principles. And so I take that saying and really call it to heart quite a bit, because we as Unitarian Universalists, we have our wonderful principles, but do we have a program? Do we have a means, a process through which we're actually going to enact these principles, to incarnate these principles in the world? And so that's what I've taken as my challenge in my ministry, is to inquire about how might we have a program for social change. So one of our principles says that we're part of an interdependent web of all existence, right? And what I in my work and with the folks who have taught me, I ask, what does interdependence actually look like, in the day-to-day? So we say, like, you know, if it's a Tuesday morning and like the car won't start and you have to get kids to school, what does interdependence look like then? So how might we, as fellow congregants in our congregations, how interdependently are we living? Or said another way, are we living in a way in which we believe we are interdependent? Are we actually showing that, living it out? And that's really my challenge to myself, to all of us. So, but there's some examples. There's some ways that can help us imagine what that might look like. And I'll tell you about one of them that's most inspiring to me. In the late 1700s, there was an organization called the Free African Society, which was an organization of formerly enslaved people in Philadelphia. And this is late 1700s. So, you know, way back, this is like 1790s. And they were a religious community, but they were also a community that strove for, spiritual development, social development, and economic development. It was all wrapped up. All this, you know, it was both a religious community and a mutual aid community. And they offered up many services to each other, from, you know, job training to unemployment insurance and the like. But in the 1790s, while the so-called founding fathers were in Philadelphia writing the Constitution itself, a yellow fever epidemic broke out, and all the so-called founding fathers, you know, left the city and went back to their estates. And the Free African Society was able to distribute hundreds upon hundreds of meals and blankets and other services for people who were, who were caught up in the yellow fever epidemic, because they had those relationships and they were able to be there for it. So that's just one example, and the the leader of the Free African Society, Absalom Jones, went on to found the AME Church afterward, just for some context. But having this capacity to act in relational ways, and act in ways that demonstrate that we believe we are actually interdependent with one another, I think that's our challenge. And just as the hymn we just sang says, that line has always been so provocative to me, giving life the shape of justice. So what would it look like for us to give life the shape of justice? I think that's just the central question for me. And now there's another another little piece, like if you're familiar with the work of the Black Panther Party, you know, through the 60s and 70s, the FBI director, his name's slipping my mind right now. Someone can maybe throw it in the chat and help me out. But the FBI director was talking about what was the most dangerous thing that the Black Panther Party ever did. And many people would think, you know, being armed or you know, other kind of, yeah, J. Edgar Hoover. Thank you, Ellie. but J. Edgar Hoover said, no, the most dangerous thing that the Black Panther Party ever did was their children's breakfast program. They had programs in Oakland and Chicago and other cities that just fed school children before they went to school, just fed breakfast to kids. So J. Edgar Hoover said this was the most dangerous thing they ever did, because they're building community here. They're building power. They're building the wherewithal to actually make a change and to dismantle some of these oppressive systems. So I love that the beautiful work that they were doing, and I would like for us to be that dangerous, to find ways to incarnate our values, our principles, and our belief in interdependence in the day-to-day, in the actual world. So I'm gonna kind of wrap us up, but I'm gonna tell just one last story before I stop today. So there was this dude named Buckminster Fuller that many of you are probably familiar with, and Bucky, as he was called, he said this really important quote, and I can put it in the chat too if y'all want to keep it. But he said, "You don't change something by fighting the existing reality. To change something, you build a new model that renders the old model obsolete." So you don't change something by fighting the existing reality, but you create a new model that makes the old model obsolete. And I think, or at least I'd like to think, that he was channeling the wisdom of his great aunt, who was Margaret Fuller, who was Unitarian, one of the leading transcendentalists, just this brilliant person. She wrote the first work of feminism, women in the 18th century, so 19th century. Margaret Fuller was an amazing example of some of this idea of creating a new model that rendered the old model obsolete, because she was the first woman allowed access into the Harvard University library. So as you know, Harvard, as were all institutions, were built by and for wealthy white men. And so all institutions were reserved only for them. But she was the first woman that was allowed access to the Harvard University Library. And she was allowed access because she was regarded as the best read person of any sort in New England, literally the best read person. So she was allowed access. And here's what she did. So women, of course, were not allowed to attend Harvard. So Margaret Fuller went into the Harvard University Library and she copied the entire Harvard curriculum at the time. And she took it, and her and another group of women, they started something called the Salon, which was an alternative school for women that was teaching the standard Harvard curriculum at the time to each other, with and to one another, because they were denied access to the institution. So this is an example of that alternative institution, or what I call liberatory institutions, that we can create that when the normal channels are are oppressive or are keeping people out. And this is not too uncommon for our faith. Our early forebears in Unitarianism believed that they were called Congregationalists because they believed in the free church that was not separated from the state, had no state oversight, and we call our own leaders and we make our own decisions, at least quasi-democratically, for hundreds and hundreds of years. And so when the Congregationalists of Europe came to this continent, they were practicing this way of community, this way of electing our own leaders, making our own decisions democratically for hundreds of years while living in a monarchy, right? So our religious forebears were actually living out a model of a better world, of a more democratic world, of a more free world in their religious communities. And it's really this example that many commentators say was kind of the inspiration for the American Revolution, that we can have a better society, a democratic society. And so the example of the Congregationalists coupled with the example of indigenous cultures like the Iroquois Confederacy, that was a democratic confederation of many nations, but those were actually they were practicing the world that could be, and gave us the hope and the faith that we can actually make a better world. So I believe that this is our work, and especially as we come out of quarantine and out of this pandemic, that we return not to normal, that we return to something new, that we return to collective imagination and dreaming about the world that we can create together. And I'll end just with this little tidbit. So on Buckminster Fuller's headstone, it says, "Call me Trim Tab," which is a weird thing. I had no idea what a trim tab was, and maybe some of you do, but a trim tab is, if you have like a really huge ocean liner, like a cargo ship, the rudder on that to actually like turn the thing, the sheer forces on the metal are too great to actually just move to turn the rudder itself. It would just tear itself off. So there's a smaller rudder on the rudder, which is called a trim tab. So to turn a really big ship, the trim tab turns, which makes the rudder turn. And then the ship, half an hour later actually makes a turn. So what Buckminster Fuller was saying, "I am trim tab," is saying that, I'm a very small force in the world, but used well, and used with, proper leverage, I can be part of turning things, of turning culture, of turning systems and institutions, and making the world a better place. So I leave you with the concept that we are trim tab, that we have the capacity to practice our principle of interdependence within and among ourselves, and doing that, creating a model, a new model for what the world could be, that we can actually begin to incarnate that in our actual lived lives. So I will leave you with that and turn it back over to Virginia for our offering this morning.